So in today's lecture, we're going to talk about some of the phenomena in quantum mechanics that are usually thought to pose problems for the foundations of the theory. So I'll probably get through at least three of these. So we're going to talk about quantum interference and what kind of problems that poses. We'll talk about the measurement problem, which is often thought of as the main problem that needs to be solved in the foundations of quantum mechanics. I personally disagree with that, and we'll see why. But nevertheless, it's an important thing to understand. And then we'll probably talk about the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument. The last two will probably be tomorrow. Okay. So interference, as we all know, is a quantum interference is often thought to be the stereotypical quantum phenomena. And if you read Feynman, he says that the double slit experiment is basically, first of all, absolutely impossible to explain in any classical way. So it contains the heart of quantum mechanics. And he also says it's really the only mystery behind quantum mechanics. So if we understand the double slit experiment, we can understand the double slit experiment, then we've understood everything. So I disagree with this. I personally think interference isn't particularly difficult to understand what's going on. We'll see that sort of in the second week of the course. But it's definitely one of the things that we'll have to explain. So what I want to do, instead of presenting the double slit experiment in, usually it's done in two-dimensional space, I want to simplify and just consider the analogous situation in just a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So we'll just look at single photons going along definite paths. Okay, so what we have to do is look at the mathematics of single photon interferometers, basically. So we imagine, so basically the mathematics of this is the same as the mathematics of a qubit. It's going to be modeled in quantum mechanics basically as a two-dimensional system. So here I have a photon source. So imagine that this is a source that produces single photons. I've given them a label. This is photon source 0 and photon source 1. So we're only ever going to consider in this section situations in which there's a total of one photon in the interferometer. So either this photon source will be turned on or this one will be turned on, okay? So I'm going to label the two paths on which the photon could be mode 0 and mode 1. And I'm going to call the state in which there's a photon in mode 0 just the 0 ket state, and where it's in mode 1, I'm going to call it the 1 state, so to label them as qubit degrees of freedom. So we basically have a qubit. Whatever kind of complicated interferometer I create with beam splitters and mirrors and so forth, I'm always going to assume that the different paths that the photon can take around the interferometer have the same path length. Okay, so that means we only need to keep track of, it means that there aren't going to be any phase differences on the paths due to having different path lengths. Okay, the phase differences are all going to come from whatever optical elements I put along these paths. Okay, so now we need to look at the other optical elements. So let's consider a beam splitter. So if I write down a beam splitter, here's a beam splitter. So I'm going. So a beam splitter has two incoming modes and two outgoing modes. So I could have a photon coming in along this path or coming in along this path, and then it could go out along this path or that path, okay? So again, it's going to be a map from a two-dimensional degree of freedom to a two-dimensional degree of freedom. And I'm going to label the paths in the following way. The transmitted beam always has the same label as the incoming beam, right? So if this is the zero mode coming in and it gets transmitted, I'm going to call that the zero mode on the outgoing end of the beam splitter, and similarly for the one mode. So if the zero mode comes in and gets reflected, then it ends up in the one mode. Okay, so the action is going to be of the beam slitter is going to be given by a unitary matrix. So all dynamics in quantum theory is unitary. So and the unitary matrix is going to look like this. So this is the coefficient of transmission. It tells you the amplitude for the zero mode to end up in the outgoing zero mode, and similarly here for the one mode. And these are the coefficients of reflection. And the transmittivity and the reflectivity of the beam splitter is just the mod squared of these values. So it's the probability that if I put a photon in the incoming zero mode, what's the probability that it'll end up in the outgoing zero mode? It's this transmittivity here. Okay, so unitarity of this matrix, you can check, implies that the transmittivity and reflectivity have to sum to one. And a special case of this is when we have a 50-50 beam splitter. A 50-50 beam splitter is modeled by this matrix. So this is a case where transmittivity and reflectivity are both a half. And the reason why we have I in here is because there is a phase change of pi when you have a reflection. Okay, so that's how a 50-50 beam slitter is modeled. And then we can have mirrors. So if I put a mirror along the zero path, as I said, when you reflect a beam of light, it gets a phase change, actually gets a pi phase change. Sorry, this one should have been pi over two. It gets a pi phase change on that path. So this is just represented by a diagonal matrix which puts an extra phase of minus one on the zero beam. And the mirror, if I put a mirror on the one beam, similarly I get a minus one there. Okay, so even though these paths in this case are different shapes, when I recombine the beams, I'm always going to ensure that the total path length is the same, right? So we don't have to keep track of more than this, the relative phases that are induced by the elements like beam splitters and mirrors. And the final element I can have is a phase shifter. And a phase shifter is just some optical element that puts an arbitrary phase on the path here. Okay, so the way that you can make a phase shifter is, for example, by inserting a block of refractive material. The refractive material will change the wavelength of the light inside that block, and so there will be a phase difference because there'll be a different number of wave fronts going through the two paths. Okay, so by choosing the refractive index of the material and the size of the block, I can, in principle, generate any phase difference I like between the two paths. Okay, so that's the mathematics of all those elements. And now, the final thing is obviously detectors. So if I put a photo detector on one of the paths, then the probability that it fires, so this is on the zero path in this case, is just the mod squared inner product as usual, the usual Born rule. And similarly, if I put a detector on this path. Okay, and if we do an ideal measurement, so remember, like most of these photo detection measurements in a real interferometer absorb the photon. But if we imagine that we have a way of doing an ideal measurement, then after the detection, the state gets updated. So if we find the photon in path zero, then after the measurement, it's in path zero. And if we find it in path one, it's after the measurement in path one. Hard to do that kind of measurement in practice, but in principle, allowed by the laws of physics to do that. Any questions about the setup of how all that works? So basically, interferometers, although most of what we do in this course, you can think of abstractly just in terms of qubits or general quantum systems, it is helpful to have in mind a physical system, and interferometers are traditionally a playground for exploring foundational ideas and also one of the places where a lot of the experiments in quantum foundations get done. All right, so now we consider a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, which is just this combination here. So we have We put a photon on the, this isn't working now. Put a photon on the incoming zero mode. It has two paths that it can take through the interferometer. They get recombined at a second beam splitter and then detected at one of the two detectors. Okay, so a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, these beam splitters here are 50-50 beam splitters. But in general, we can put a phase shifter on this path here. So the state just before detection is just this. So you start with a photon in the zero mode, you apply the beam splitter unitary, the two mirrors, then the phase shifter, then a beam splitter again. Okay, and it is on one of the tutorials that you will do to show that the probabilities of detection at the two detectors here are given by these formulas, so sine squared. So it depends on the phase shift. Let's see, where's the phase shifter? Okay, it depends on the phase shift that we put in this in these phase shifters in the following way. Okay, so it's sine squared phi over 2 and cos squared phi over 2. Okay, so if we have no phase shifter, in particular, if we have no phase shifter here, phase is zero, then the photon always gets detected on path one. Okay, and that's an interference effect. It's due to the fact that that these two beams coming in here, the outgoing beams on path one constructively interfere, and the outgoing beams on path zero constructively interfere. No, that's the other way around. Yeah, no, that's right. These destructively interfere and these constructively interfere. Okay, right. So it's an interference effect. We always see the detector one fire and never the detector zero. Okay, so this is how this Feynman sets up the paradox of quantum interference. So if we think classically, then things either behave as particles or they behave as waves, right? They're mutually exclusive. The fact that we see interference at that second beam splitter indicates that the photon is behaving like a wave, right? Waves interfere, and that's the only way we could get all of the output coming in this beam here. We're dealing with a single photon, right? So we're not getting so if we're putting a single photon through this interferometer at a time, we're not getting a continuous signal, which you would get from a classical wave field. We're getting discrete clicks, and that indicates that we're talking about a particle. So if we're talking about a particle, you know, classically you'd think, well, a particle should travel along path zero or path one, right? If it's really a particle throughout here, then either it goes this way, oh, sorry, it comes out one. Either it goes this way or it goes this way. Okay, so which is it? So what happens? What happens if we try to check? So the way Feynman sets it up is he imagines that we put detectors on these paths, and these are ideal detectors, so that they don't destroy the photon somehow. So if the photon is detected here, then it stays in path zero afterwards. Okay, so now the math is slightly different. We just have to apply a beam splitter. Beam splitter is just because the beam splitter matrix is like 1, i, 1. It's just going to map this to a superposition of 0 and 1. And then the mirrors, they just put a phase on each path, a phase of minus 1 on each path. So after the first beam splitter, before we hit the detectors, after these two mirrors, this is the state of the system. And because that's an equal superposition of 0 and 1, each detector is going to click with 50-50 probability. So either we'll see that the photon's on path 1 or it's on path 0 with 50-50 probability. And then we update the state of the system. So after the measurement, either we'll be on path 0 or path 1 with 50-50 probability. Next, we encounter the second beam splitter. And the beam splitter, if we're in state 0, is going to map me to an equal superposition of 0 and 1. And similarly, if I'm in 1, it's going to map me to an equal superposition. The phase The phases are different, but it's still an equal superposition. So in this case, if I'll now see that there's equal amplitude to be at both detectors, so each of the two detectors will click with 50% probability. And the same is true here. So if I detect which path the photon traveled down, then I will lose the interference, and I'll find there's a 50-50 probability of being on each of the two output paths. So if you attempt to check which path the photon travels along, that destroys the interference effect, and now you see that the photon is behaving something like a particle. So the question is, which is it? The traditional resolution that you see in textbooks, at least relatively careful textbooks, is that there's this concept of wave-particle duality, which is in the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. And it says that a photon, or indeed any quantum particle, behaves either like a particle or a wave, depending on how you have set up the experiment. Okay, so the way the particle responds just depends on what you're looking at. So if you set up an experiment that's designed to detect particle paths, you will not see any interference. You'll just see the photon behaving like a particle going along a definite trajectory. If you set up an experiment to detect interference, then you necessarily cannot say which path the photon travels along. You necessarily have no information about which path it's traveled along. So according to Copenhagen-style ideas, the question of which path a photon travels on during an interference experiment, when we observe interference, just has no meaning. Okay, so when I'm doing this experiment here, the one without the detectors on the paths, there's just no meaning to the question of which path does the photon travel along. That's the traditional resolution. Both in the popular science literature and in some published papers, you'll often hear people say things like the photon travels along both paths, or it travels along neither path. But at least according to my reading, the has no meaning is closer to what Copenhagen and textbook accounts of quantum mechanics actually say about this. Okay, so that's the traditional resolution. But as I said, we want to treat these kinds of questions with a certain amount of skepticism. What's the evidence? Where's the real evidence that something strange is going on here? So let's criticize this kind of traditional resolution. So first of all, it assumes that photons have to behave either like waves or particles, right? So in classical physics, if you've learned a lot of classical physics, which I presume you have, then there are basically two types of things in classical physics. There are particles and there are fields. Fields can have wave-like solutions. And you get used to the idea that everything should be thought of as either a particle or a field or a wave. But there's no reason why the reality underlying quantum mechanics should be anything really like classical reality. So the question is, well, why can't photons behave like both particles and waves at the same time? Why can't I say there's a wave and a particle? And this kind of resolution does occur in at least one interpretation of quantum mechanics that we will talk about towards the end of the course. Or something else entirely, right? Why do I have to limit my imagination to whatever the terms of classical physics are? We know that quantum mechanics is strange, so whatever is the reality underlying quantum mechanics, don't really expect it to be much like classical reality. So the other issue, which is possibly a bigger issue, is that there's an assumption here that, and this is a very common assumption that physicists make, which is that having a property is the same thing as being able to measure that property, and in particular without disturbing anything else, right? So the idea that we could go here and say that, well, the only way I can assign a meaning to which path the photon travels along is to put a detector in that path, right? I should be able to put a detector in that path, and if it has a well-defined trajectory, then I'll find it, right? It's the idea that you need to be able to verify it like that. You could imagine that the photon has a trajectory that's just unmeasurable. Arguably, this does happen in de Broglie-Bohm. Or it's measurable, but not without disturbing some other property, right? And that other property is responsible for interference. So you don't have to imagine. So you can imagine that these detectors here, that there actually is something going along this path or going along that path. But what happens when it encounters a detector is that its state gets messed up in some way, right? It gets changed. And that change is responsible for the fact that when you hit the beam splitter, you don't get interference anymore. Certainly imagine that that's the case. And we will see theories like this later on in the course. So I would argue that interference is rather weak evidence for quantum weirdness. You're assuming a lot about what the structure of the theory has to be about. Obviously, we shall have to explain how this phenomena works in any proposed interpretation of quantum mechanics. But it will turn out that there are much more difficult problems to solve than this one. Okay, any questions about that before we move on? Okay, so there is a wrinkle on this sort of interference paradox, which is a little bit more modern, which makes it seem much more dramatic. And this is called the Elitzer-Weibmann bomb test. Some of you may have heard of this before. So what we imagine is all of these things are theorist setups, right? You know, I'm assuming that light travels along one-dimensional paths and things like that. So this is a very, very much a theorist's device. So imagine that we have a very sensitive bomb. We're considering a very sensitive bomb. It will explode as soon as even the tiniest amount of electromagnetic radiation is incident on it. So it has to be very carefully protected inside an extremely dark box, right? And we don't know whether the bomb is a good bomb or a dud bomb. Okay, so it might be that we have a well-manufactured bomb, and as soon as any light hits it, it will explode, or it might be that it's been badly manufactured and nothing will happen if light hits it. Question is, can we tell whether the bomb is good or a dud without blowing yourself up? Now, classically, you wouldn't be able to do this because the only way of checking whether the bomb is good is to shine some light on it. And then if it's a good bomb, you will blow yourself up, okay? But quantum mechanically, it turns out that you can do this. And it's basically just a variation of the previous Feynman paradox. The idea is, first of all, what we do is we put the bomb in a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So we're going to put the bomb along path one here. And if the bomb is a dud, then it does nothing, right? Just photon passes straight through the bomb. So if it's the bomb's a dud, we just have an ordinary Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And as we've determined, the photon will always be detected here, okay? However, if the bomb is good, it's going to act as a detector, right? if the bomb blows up, it means that we can infer that the photon was on path one. Photon was detected on path one, okay? And if the bomb doesn't blow up, then, and it's a good bomb, then it must have been on path zero. So it acts as a detector, so suppose we learn that the photon is on path zero because the bomb didn't blow up, then the state of the system will be updated to zero and it'll have a 50-50 chance of coming out of both of these paths. If the bomb did blow up, then that's the end of the experiment, so we no longer have the photon. So the conclusion of this is that suppose detector zero clicks in your experiment, then you know that the bomb is a good bomb, because otherwise it would have always come out in path one. And we know that the photon didn't touch the bomb. Okay. So with probability half, if you have a good bomb, you're able to detect that the bomb is good without blowing yourself up. Okay. And this is basically just a sort of more dramatic rendering of the Feynman paradox, because we've just replaced the idea of having detectors there with this bomb. Okay. So first of all, one thing to note about this is it's still not a very good idea to blow yourself up with probability a half. And I believe, is this a tutorial question or a homework question now? I can remember. Yeah, there's going to be a homework question where you will show that you can make the probability of detecting whether the bomb is good or dud without blowing yourself up as close to one as you like by using a more sophisticated interferometer setup. So you can basically boost the probability of a successful detection as high as you like at the expense of having to do more rounds of through the interferometer. Now, one of the reasons why people are interested in this kind of wrinkle here is that sometimes people claim that the Elitzer-Weidman-Bohm test is evidence for non-locality. Why? Because, well, we determined for sure that the photon went nowhere near the bomb. So suppose we get a click in this detector. Then we know for sure that the photon went nowhere near the bomb, but somehow the presence of the bomb, the fact that the bomb is there, still influenced what the particle did. Because if there was no bomb there, the particle would always come out on one. So somehow a photon which is going round path zero knows that there's a bomb in path one where it goes nowhere near. So again, I'm not too impressed with this, because what this assumes is that if the photon goes along path zero, in the sense that it gets detected on path zero, then there is literally nothing that goes along path one. Right? In order for the bomb to have an effect on something locally, there has to be something that goes down path one so that can convey the information that there's a bomb here to this second beam splitter. Okay. So if you really assume that when you're dealing with a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, all there is some degree of freedom which goes along one path or the other, and that's the only thing that's going through the interferometer, then that's very puzzling. But why should we think that absolutely nothing goes through path one? Especially if we get ourselves beyond the dichotomy that things have to be either waves or particles. In particular, if you think about quantum field theory, you should be a little bit skeptical that there's nothing going through this arm of the interferometer, because as we know, the vacuum state, which is the state where there's nothing there, has substructure. It is also a quantum state. And so if we think that there's some reality underlying quantum states, that could have a structure which mediates the influence. And again, we will see a theory which works just like this a little bit later in the course, right? So certainly not a slam dunk evidence for non-locality. We'll have to do better. So what I want to, you know, what I want to emphasize here is that I'm trying to make the arguments that there's something weird about quantum mechanics at a level of rigor that goes beyond these kinds of statements. Okay, so we're going to have to do better than these kind of examples, ultimately. Any questions about that? Okay, let's see. Right. All right, so now I want to talk about the measurement problem. So the measurement problem is usually thought to be the biggest problem in the foundations of quantum mechanics. However, they've been solved multiple times. So if you're studying quantum foundations because you think it's urgent that I must solve the measurement problem right now, I have good news for you. It's been solved many, many times. Every single interpretation of quantum mechanics that we're going to talk about at the end of the course solves the measurement problem. So if you thought that was the biggest problem and nothing else was really a problem, then you're done. Okay, just come back in week three and we'll talk about the possible solutions. So that means that they're not problems, they're not problems with quantum theory per se, right? It's not, there's nothing in the predictions of quantum mechanics that's a problem, but they are problems with the way quantum theory is usually discussed in textbooks. Okay, so if we're looking for, remember last time we saw Feynman worrying about whether there actually was a problem with quantum mechanics. So if we're looking to try and define that problem, I personally don't define it as the measurement problem. I'd like to define it differently. And I'll do that at the beginning of next week. I would like to say this isn't the problem, but we need to understand what it is. Okay, so it's not a problem with quantum mechanics, but it's a problem with a particular way of looking at quantum mechanics. And this particular way of looking at quantum mechanics is known in the literature by various names, either the orthodox interpretation, the textbook interpretation, or the Dirac von Neumann interpretation, because it really has its origins in the books of Dirac and von Neumann wrote at the beginning of quantum mechanics. Often this interpretation is mislabeled as the Copenhagen interpretation. Copenhagen interpretation is supposed to refer to the views of the founders of quantum theory like Bohr and Heisenberg, and it's quite a nebulous concept and difficult to pin down exactly what it is. We will try to do that towards the end of the course. But it's actually very different from what's written in textbooks. Okay, so this stuff, Copenhagen stuff, is quite hard to understand what it is. This is quite straightforward to understand what it is, but also obviously wrong, as we'll see. Okay, so we'll talk about Copenhagen much later, but let's talk about what textbooks sometimes say. So this is often, it's often not written down as explicitly as this, but this is sort of implicitly what's behind some of the statements that you see in textbooks. The first thing is that, and this is all in addition to the postulates of quantum mechanics. The postulates of quantum mechanics, when I was describing them yesterday, I was trying to be careful not to talk about systems having properties and things like that. I was just talking about what you will observe when you, when I talked about the measurement postulates, I just talked about what you would observe if you make a measurement. So I was trying to be careful not to ascribe systems properties other than what we observe in the lab. But in textbooks, you often see more than that. So first of all, you often read that the possible properties of a system are its observables. So systems have some properties, and the possible properties it can have are its observables. So a particle can have a position, or it can have a momentum. It might not have all of them at the same time. Possible values of those properties are the eigenvalues. Okay, so the eigenvalues of the operators are the values that those properties can take. And then the second statement is often in, especially in the philosophical literature on quantum mechanics, often called the eigenvalue-eigenstate link. Okay, so the idea is that if the system is in an eigenstate of observable m, which has eigenvalue little m, then in that case, big M is a property of the system and it has value little m. Okay. So if the system is in an eigenstate of momentum, say, then in that situation, I can say the system has a definite momentum. It's a property of the system, and the value is the corresponding eigenvalue. And there's another part to it, which is also equally important, which is to say there are no other objective properties than these. Okay. So if I'm in a momentum eigenstate, then the particle has no position, right? It's not just it has a position and we don't know what it is, but there is no meaning to saying what's the position of the particle in that case. This is kind of the orthodox interpretation where we kind of read the properties of the system off of what observables it's an eigenstate of. Any questions about what that means? So I would argue that this kind of idea is behind a lot of what people think are problems with quantum mechanics. So first of all, let's note that this eigenvalue eigenstate link is equivalent to just saying that the quantum state is an objective property of a quantum system. So the quantum state is a property of a system in the same way that position and momentum are properties of a classical particle, right? And also that it is the only such property of the system. Why is that the case? Because the projector onto psi is an observable, and psi is an eigenstate of that observable with eigenvalue 1, okay? And this sort of uniquely specifies the quantum state as a property of the system. This is the only quantum state that satisfies this property. So this uniquely determines psi up to a global phase, of course, because the global phase will disappear in this projector. So that means by the eigenvalue eigenstate link, then it's a property of the system. Then all other objective physical properties that exist are uniquely determined by psi, because once we know what psi is, we can obviously figure out what other observables it's an eigenstate of. So really, the orthodox interpretation is equivalent to saying the quantum state psi is an objective property of an individual quantum system, and it's the only one. Okay. Right, so why does this cause a problem? Oh, yeah, so I just want to give you some terminology that will crop up several times in the course about different interpretations of quantum theory properties they can have. So a theory in which quantum state is an objective property of an individual quantum system is usually called a psi-ontic theory. Ontology, the Greek word ontology, means things that refer to reality, right? So psi-ontic means quantum state is real. Psi-ontic theories, however, could have additional degrees of freedom. You could have other properties beyond the quantum state. For instance, you might have the quantum state and particles with definite trajectories. That happens in de Broglie-Bohm theory, for instance. So a subset of psi-ontic theories are the theories which are psi-complete. This is a theory in which is psi-ontic and in which psi is the only objective property. And that would characterize, for example, the orthodox interpretation that I've just described. And there's another alternative, which actually the real Copenhagen interpretation, the actual Copenhagen interpretation, fits more into this category, which is basically denies that the quantum state is a state of reality at all. It is a theory in which you should view the quantum state as having a similar status to a probability distribution. And depending on how you think about probability distributions, and well, we don't have time to get into this, but the foundations of probability are almost as fraught as the foundations of quantum theory itself. So you might be inclined to call the quantum state epistemic, an ensemble state, a statistical state, or words like that, depending on how you think about what probabilities mean. But the idea here is that basically, you know, the quantum state has a similar status. It's more similar to the probability distributions that you use in, say, statistical mechanics than it is to something like the position and momentum of the particle. Okay, so these problems that we're talking about, measurement problem, is a problem with psi-complete theories, primarily. Okay, so the measurement problem is closely related to Schrödinger's cat. I'm sure you've heard of Schrödinger's famous cat. This is the quote from Schrödinger. So in 1935, Schrödinger wrote two papers, one of which introduced the concept of, well, they both actually introduced the concept of entanglement and talked about this case of Schrödinger's cat. I'm not going to read out the whole quote, but I'm sure you're familiar with the idea. You have a cat inside a box with a radioactive atom, and you wait into a situation in which there's a probability that you wait until there's a probability of 50% of the atom having decayed. Then if a decay is detected, it triggers some kind of mechanism in the box which kills the cat. And the idea is that Inside the box, if you don't look inside the box and you imagine that inside the box is a completely isolated quantum system, then the cat will end up in a wave function, which is 50-50 superposition of being alive and dead. Okay, so the idea is that if we interact a microscopic system with a microscopic system, such as an atom, that's in a superposition, then we can generate superpositions of macroscopically distinct states like cat is alive plus cat is dead. Now, if we believe the orthodox interpretation, then this is a situation in which we cannot say that the cat is either alive or dead, because cat is alive, the observable, which has eigenstates, cat is alive and cat is dead, is not, this is not an eigenstate of that. So there's no meaning to that observable. Okay, so this is not a situation, according to the orthodox interpretation, this is not a situation in which either the cat is alive or the cat is dead, but we don't know, but something genuinely different. So this, according to orthodox interpretation, there's a physical distinction between this, necessarily a physical distinction between this and or these two situations in which we could say the cat is alive or the cat is dead. And the macroscopic superposition doesn't correspond to anything, doesn't seem to correspond to anything in our everyday experience. I don't know what it means to experience this situation, right? I've never seen cats that are neither dead or alive. So the question is that given it's so easy by interacting microscopic systems with macroscopic ones to generate states like this, given that it ought to happen inside a box, if you just have a radioactive atom inside there, why is it, I mean, how can we even interpret what this means? That's really the problem of Schrodinger's cat. The problem of Schrodinger's cat is very closely related to the measurement problem. I would argue that it's not exactly the same thing. So let's look at the measurement problem. So the point is that there are two ways of handling measurements in quantum theory via the measurement postulates. The measurement postulates tell us that when we make a measurement, we look at the probability rule and we get either one outcome or the other, and then the state changes, collapses. The second way of looking at it is to say, well, if I'm making a measurement, then I'm using some kind of physical system to make that measurement, a measurement device, and that's made up of atoms, made up of the same kinds of things as everything else in the world, so it ought to be describable as a quantum system, and quantum systems interact unitarily with each other according to the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so we have two choices. We can either just apply the measurement postulates or we can try to describe the measurement device itself as a physical quantum system. Okay, so let's consider just a simple case of we've got a qubit in the superposition of 0 and 1, and we're going to perform an ideal measurement of it in the basis 0 versus 1. Okay, so if we apply the measurement postulates, then with probability mod alpha squared, we'll find the outcome 0, and we'll end up in the state 0. And with probability mod beta squared, we end up in the state 1. Okay, so that's what the measurement postulates tell us should happen. Now let's consider the measurement device as a physical system. So what I'm going to do is just include as much of... So the measurement device, when I say the measurement device, it can include the actual physical measurement device itself with its pointer reading and whatever, but also as much of the environment as you like, that I can describe the whole thing as an isolated quantum system. Okay, so I might have to include much of the laboratory in my description of the measurement device to do that. So we imagine that our measurement device is also a quantum system, and it has some state in which it is ready to perform the measurement. Okay, so maybe, you know, if it's a voltmeter, it's like got its pointer sitting at 0 before I've connected it to anything. That's the ready state in that case. Okay. Now there's a unitary interaction between the system and the measurement device. Is going to be described by some unitary operator. We don't here need to worry about the details of what Hamiltonian is generating this. but we know it's a unitary interaction. Okay, so let M naught be a state in which the measurement device is registering the outcome zero, and M1 be a state in which it's registering outcome one. If this unitary represents a good measurement, then it should be the case that when I start in the zero state and the ready state, it gets mapped to this state where the measurement device is indicating zero, and similarly over here. So if I start in the one state, then the measurement device ends up indicating one. So now we apply the superposition principle. We know that the unitary dynamics is linear. So when we apply this to our superposition of zero and one, then we end up in this state here, not either zero or one. It's a superposition. So according to the orthodox interpretation, again, it's the same kind of deal as we had with Schrodinger's cat. These things are physically distinct, right? This thing is not an eigenstate of of a measurement in the zero versus one basis. These are. So they have different physical properties. So assuming we're right, assuming that we agree that you can indeed model measurements by unitary interaction, then this is a flat out contradiction, right? This is a contradiction. The orthodox interpretation is just straightforwardly wrong. It's incompatible with the idea, at least it's incompatible with the idea that I can measure, that I can implement measurements by unitary interaction. Okay. So since most people start from something like the orthodox interpretation in their head, this is why this is usually considered a very big problem. But of course, we have other interpretations which don't have this problem. Okay. Let me just say this as well. I mean, this is sort of just one of my personal nitpicks. It's not very important. But often people will say that the measurement problem and Schrodinger's cat problem are the same thing, right? And that's basically true if you assume that the measurement device here is a macroscopically large classical system, something like made of many, many atoms like a cat is, right? And in most interpretations of quantum mechanics, that's what it takes to do a measurement. But there are a few interpretations of quantum mechanics out there which say things like an electron can measure another electron, right? So if you're thinking about that kind of interpretation, then in that case, this measurement device isn't a macroscopic system like of the same size as a cat, in which case you think, if you believe in that interpretation, you think the measurement problem is distinct from Schrodinger's cat problem. So they're the same problem, provided we agree that a measurement is necessarily an interaction with a macroscopically large system, which most people believe, so it's fine. But not everybody believes that. All right, so let's make some comments on the measurement problem. It's obviously a problem for any psi-complete theory, right? So if you just have the quantum state being real, and that's what that is, then you have a problem. Note that if you had a psiontic but not psi-complete theory, then you might have some additional variables in your theory in addition to just the quantum state. So those additional variables, whatever they are, they might be positions of particles or something like that, might be able to determine which of the two branches of this superposition actually represents reality, actually represents what you'll see. And then if you take that point of view, you would say, oh, well, the measurement postulates are just a mathematical shortcut. They just tell me to get rid of the branch of the wave function that's actually not relevant to what I'm going to see. It's just a mathematical shortcut. Allows us to avoid tracking the true joint state of the system and measurement device, most of which is just irrelevant to what we see. And so that's actually what happens in some theories like de Broglie-Bohm theory. I seem to be mentioning de Broglie-Bohm a lot, not because I like de Broglie-Bohm particularly, but just because it is an example, as we'll see, where a lot of these problems get solved in this way. If you have a psi-epistemic theory, then the point is, I don't think of this thing as representing reality at all. I just think of it as representing something like a probability distribution. And even in classical probability distributions, probability distributions change when you learn something, right? If I have a coin, if I flip a coin and I don't show you whether it's landed heads or tails, then you will have a probability distribution 50-50 heads or tails. If I look at the coin, I'll know whether it's heads or tails. I'll assign either definitely heads or definitely tails to it, whilst you will assign still 50-50 mixture. Those are two different probability distributions. It's not a contradiction. They're compatible with each other. So a psi epistemicist will just say, well, these are just two different descriptions that different people who have access to different information would make. So there's not necessarily a contradiction here, because in the psi epistemic approach, we haven't assigned reality to any of these statements. Are there any questions about that? No? Okay. All right, so let's see, how long do we have? 10 minutes or so. All right, so, I just wanted to say this too. You can also take the point of view that, look, forget about all of this. I'm only ever going to make statements about what I observe in measurements, okay? Let's forget about talking about real properties of the system at all. And that's called like an operational interpretation, where you only worry about things that are directly observable. So in that case, the problem after we stated it doesn't apply, because it's not a problem about observable things. However, if you are an operationalist, then you have to take measurement as an undefined primitive. Right? It's like there is something that it means for a measurement to be done, and I don't analyze what that is, I just talk about the probabilities, the outcomes. So we still have a problem that there's no principle yet which tells us when you should apply the measurement postulates and when you apply unitary dynamics. You just have this undefined primitive measurement, which is like when measurement happens, I apply the measurement postulates. Or when does measurement happen? There's no answer to that as of yet. So in practice, it doesn't cause a lot of problems in practice. Of course, we usually know when we should apply the measurement postulates. But having a fundamental theory that has measurement in it as an undefined primitive is arguably incomplete. There should be some way of determining what is a measurement and what isn't a measurement from the fundamental physics. Okay, I'll start talking about this anyway. Next thing we want to talk about is the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument. And again, I would phrase this as a conflict between orthodox quantum theory and locality. Not quantum theory per se, but quantum theory with the eigenvalue-eigenstate link. So the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument, as you probably know, is based on the idea of quantum entanglement. The concept of quantum entanglement, or the word quantum entanglement, was introduced by Schrödinger, and he called it not the one, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces its entire departure from classical lines of thought. So entanglement is certainly important, and we'll see later in the course that it poses some of the biggest puzzles for quantum foundations. So just to review, last time we said that if we have two systems, each with their own Hilbert space, the joint system is described by the tensor product. It consists of all states that can be written like this. Okay. So a state is called a product state if it is just a direct product of a state of A and a state on B. Okay. So if I can find some vector on A and vector on B and just take their direct product, that's a situation where each of the subsystems has its own definite state, and that's called a product state. If it's not of this form, then it's an entangled state. Okay, so most of the states, like the product states are a measure zero set, so most of the states of this form cannot be written like this. Now, if you think about the orthodox interpretation is basically equivalent to saying that the quantum state is the only and a complete state of reality. So when you have an entangled state, there is no state of the subsystems. So in the orthodox interpretation, when you have an entangled state, systems A and B have no individual properties on their own. There's only some joint property of A and B, which is that entangled state. So that's kind of an odd sort of situation of holism that you get into holistic ideas with the orthodox interpretation and entangled states. Okay, so if we have two qubits, then this is what a general state looks like, and it's very easy, fairly easy to convince yourself that a product state has to satisfy this condition. The product of these two coefficients has to equal the product of those two coefficients. So if you have a state that doesn't obey that, then it's entangled. And this is so this is an example of an entangled state because the product of these two components is a half, and the product of these two components is zero. So that must be entangled. And So if we look at just these two Pauli operators, so the Pauli X and the Pauli Z operators, and we consider measurements of observables in the plane defined by these two directions. So here n is a unit vector, so we consider these observables of this form. Then it's not too hard to convince yourself that you can rewrite this state in the n basis like this. So this is a state that has perfect correlations in all bases in the sigma 1, sigma 3 plane. Okay. So if I make any measurements, say these are spin a half particles, if I make any measurement in the xz plane, then you'll find that the two systems are perfectly correlated with one another. Okay, so just to reiterate this. So if you have a joint system and you measure one of the subsystems in an orthonormal basis, then after the measurement, if it's entangled, after the measurement, you'll find that you end up in a product state. So if the joint system is in this state, and if I measure system A in the basis by M and I obtain this particular outcome, then I update the state by doing basically a partial inner product. I just take the inner product with the A degrees of freedom. So that means basically do this, right? This is the probability of obtaining that outcome, and this is the state afterwards, and then I normalize it. Actually, I think I missed a square root. I think there should be a square root here. Okay, so in particular, if we take this state phi plus and we measure it in the 0, 1 basis, then after the measurement, system B will be in the corresponding state. So if we measure this in the 0, 1 basis, then system B ends up in 0 if 0A was found, and it ends up in 1 if 1 was found on A. And more generally, if we measure it in any of these bases in the xz plane of the Bloch sphere, then we'll get perfect correlations. So if we find the n plus outcome, then system B will be in the n plus state then. The upshot of this is that if I measure in the direction n on system A, then after seeing the outcome of that measurement, I'll be able to predict the result of the same measurement on system B with certainty. System B will be an eigenstate of that observable. Okay, so this is the... Oh, I'm really low on time, but let me just... We'll probably have to review this beginning of next time. But this is the argument that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen made. So they introduced this criterion of reality, which says if without in any way disturbing a system, we can predict with certainty the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of reality corresponding to that quantity. Now, the important thing is, what do they mean by does not disturb? Well, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen appealed to the concept of locality to make that case. So if we have a source of qubits which are entangled in this maximally entangled state, and we send one of them out to, we send them very far apart from each other, like at the speed of light, say they're photons, then we can very easily arrange a situation where our measurement of system A is at space-like separation to the measurement on system B. And therefore, if you believe in the concept of locality, then making a measurement on system A cannot affect the properties of system B because it would have to happen at faster than the speed of light. So in this way, this is what they meant when they said that the measurement of system A can't disturb the properties of system B in this case. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, it means that if I measure system A in the 0-1 basis, then afterwards I can predict with certainty what will happen if I measure 0-1 on system B. But by locality, that measurement on system A hasn't disturbed system B. So if it has a property after I've done the measurement, then it has to have had that property beforehand. In the orthodox interpretation, it does not have that property, right? The orthodox interpretation is, according to Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, non-local. And the reason it's non-local is because the property of system B, whether it's 0 or 1, somehow pops into existence when I make the measurement on system A. Before the measurement, the system is not in an eigenstate of 0 versus 1 on system B. After I've made the measurement on system A, it is. And so somehow, by making the measurement on system A, an element of reality has popped into existence on system B, according to the orthodox interpretation. But this doesn't really just apply to the orthodox interpretation. In any interpretation in which the result of the B measurement is undetermined before A is measured would violate EPR's condition. Right? Any time we have the reality popping into existence only after I've measured system A, that's going to be non-local according to EPR. Now, in the original EPR paper, actually, they used a slightly different example in this, but in the EPR paper, they used the fact that you actually have correlations, you have perfect correlations in other bases too, right? So actually, Alice may choose to measure in the 0-1 basis, or she may choose to measure in some other basis, n plus, n minus. And the point is that Bob's system over there cannot know in advance what Alice is going to measure. Okay, so she could measure in any of these directions, and whichever of them she measured, Bob's system would have to have the corresponding result afterwards. So according to their locality condition, all of these measurements in all of these bases must be elements of reality. And that would definitely violate the uncertainty principle, right? So having all of these measurements in all of these directions be definite before the measurement is done, that would violate the uncertainty principle. However, so that is a point that was made in the EPR paper, but it's not really the main thrust of the argument. The main thrust of the argument holds for just one measurement, right? Make the argument with just 0 versus 1. The uncertainty principle stuff does play a role in a slightly different argument, which Einstein also made. You can use this uncertainty principle argument to show that if you want a local theory, it would have to be psi epistemic. And there's an article which describes this argument there. However, we don't really need to talk about that because later on in the course, we'll see that Bell's theorem will show that we can't complete quantum theory in any way that restores locality. But that's something we'll talk about much later. Okay, so sorry for going a few minutes over. That's it for today.